All right. Again, my name's Toby and I'm an alcoholic. When I first came in the program years ago in treatment, we used to go to this meeting church up there that on Fletch. It was on the Mapledale, or it was at the Methodist Church up there on Fletcher. And I was new, and I was listening, trying to find a way to, in order to stay clean and free from drugs and alcohol. And there are a few people that I remember at that time from those clouded times, you know. And one of them was this person. I don't know why. It was something, the way she spoke, what she said, her manner, who knows what it was. But later on, as this group developed, she started coming to this meeting. This meeting here with the 164 group. And I've seen her grow. I've seen her go through school. I've seen her graduate. I've been to parties at her house. And I've actually seen the way life can be sober. And she's been a fantastic role model as far as living these steps. So it's with a great respect and a great honor that I ask Ms. Sarah N. to come speak tonight.
For the 164. Anyhow, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Sarah.
Hi, Sarah.
And I want to thank you all for allowing me to share my experience, strength, and hope. You know, it's always good to remember what it was like, you know, so I don't get too cocky because it has been a wild adventure in sobriety. And my life is completely different today than when I got here. My sobriety date is May 14th, 2001. And that morning, I woke up, I was miserable. I had been staying in an apartment that I hadn't paid rent on. It was a garage apartment, a one room. You couldn't swing a cat in it, and I had four. So it was like this real dingy one-room apartment down in Seminole Heights, and I hadn't paid the rent in months, and the only reason I hadn't gotten an eviction notice is one of the landlords had a heart attack. You know, they were too sick to kick me out, and I hadn't paid the electric, so there was no power, and I was a mess. I was absolutely a mess, and I was using alcohol in all its many forms. And so I was geeking, tweaking, and freaking. It was bad. And there was nobody wanted anything to do with me. You know, my family was done with me. I had called my dad up, and I was on a waiting list to get into a halfway house, and I was trying to go into treatment. Over at the Center for Women. I mean, because I'd been around the block, you know, this wasn't my, you know, but that morning I woke up and I was dirty, I was tired, I was hungover, I was just worn out, and I just wanted to take a bath, a nice hot bath. It's all I wanted. I go to get in that shower and I turned on the water, and there was no cold water at all. It was all hot. I mean, it was so scalding hot that I could not stand under the water to get clean. I literally could not. It was too hot. And my life had become so messed up and unmanageable that I couldn't even get a shower. You know what I mean? Like, it was ridiculous. You know, I wasn't washing my clothes because every dime went to the alcohol, you know, so it was just, it was a mess. It was an absolute mess. So that's how I got there. Now, I didn't just, you know, wake up one morning in this hotel. You know, it took me a while to get to that point where simple things like taking a bath and brushing my teeth and washing my clothes became these monumentous issues in my life. I grew up in a very nice home. I'm an only child. Had a lot of extended family. And, you know, I was thinking about, like, my personality as a little kid. And I don't know if I was, like, I was pretty manipulative. Like, I was able to get what I wanted if I had to steal it or, you know, come up with a tall tale or whatever it, you know. I had no qualms about that. You know, I can remember the first time I stole something. You know, I stole some gum in a dime store and my mother asked me about it. And I was like, oh, the lady gave it to me. And, you know, like, it just came flying out of my mouth that easy, you know. And I was always that way. I was, you know, never cash register honest. That's always been that's a hard one for me. And it's still, you know, if I found your wallet on the floor, it would take everything I would have to give it, you know, and then I'd pat myself on the back when I gave it to you. I really would. I mean, and that's, you know, it's growth. You know, I'd like to think I would give it back to you today. As a sober woman, I will say that I will. But, you know, I literally would have to think about it. You know, do I do this or do I do that? And that's just something that's ingrained in my personality. So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with some, you know, before I even took a drink. You know, some, we call them character defects in here. And the way they break it down that makes sense to me is fear that I'm not going to get something I want or need, or fear that I'm going to lose something I already have. So it's all fear-based, you know, I'm not going to get my needs met. And, you know, and I can look back in my life today and see some of that fear as a little kid, but I mean, my parents are good people. They, you know, they did the best they could. Sure, they made mistakes. We had some crazy relatives living with us. And I mean, literally, you know, coming out of the insane asylum crazy. And I was left in there. You know, so there was some dysfunction in the household. And, you know, which kind of, I used, that was a good excuse for me for a long time to drink. And you go tell a psychiatrist, if you have a family history and both sides of the family, there's mental illness, script, and oh, you poor, of course you're, you know, nuts, you know, you come by it on, you know, and I mean, so I would take that, I'd get that card stamped all the time, you know, oh yeah, it's, you know, I'm not an alcoholic, I'm crazy, you know, the whole family's crazy. So anyhow, that was part of the madness. But so anyhow, let's see, I'm 50 years old now. So when I, growing up though, I grew up in a household where drinking was completely normal. You know, dad would come home after work, he'd pour a couple of fingers of whiskey, you know, they'd have wine with dinner, and nobody got ugly. Nobody fought, nobody lost jobs, everybody was educated, articulate, and it was beautiful, you know, it really was. And I learned at a young age, you know, how to have a little cocktail before dinner or a little brandy after on special occasions, you know, to drink like a lady, you know, what fork to use, what port to drink or whatever, you know. So it wasn't, like, I didn't grow up in a house where alcohol was, it just was a part, and it was very beautiful and glamorous, and very grown up. And, you know, so I started drinking. I was allowed to drink at a young age, and I liked it. I liked the taste. I liked everything about it. I started drinking alcoholically by the time I was 14. I was starting to black out. And it was starting to create problems in my life at that young age. By the time I was 15, I was to the point where I had left that home and moved in with a guy that I had just met that afternoon down on the Fort Lauderdale Strip. I grew up down in Fort Lauderdale. I was using very hard street drugs. You know, and I dropped out of school. By the time I was 16, I was injecting it right into my veins. I was a risk taker. I didn't give a damn, and you couldn't tell me a thing. I had severe, profound consequences right out of the gate. Right out of the gate, I was in a constant blackout, constantly impaired, and I was calling the shots. And you couldn't tell me anything. And what's sad about that, Like, I was just so removed from everything. You know, I'm just now getting kind of a sense of that, you know, like, just how removed I was, you know. And there was a lot of, I look at a 14, 15, 16-year-old girl today, and I'm like, yikes, you know. I put myself in harm's way a lot. And, you know, I'm fortunate that I survived some of that stuff. I really am. I'm very fortunate to have survived it. You know, it might be one of the reasons I don't have children. I don't know. Too scary to think of that. But anyhow, that's how it was. And, you know, like I said, there was some dysfunction in the household. I've come to learn that a lot of times the one that's making the, you know, doing the crazy stuff like I was doing is actually the healthiest person, because they're trying to get attention. Like, there's a problem over here, you know. When you have a child that's acting out like that, that's generally what that means. But whatever, you know, I acted out and nobody knew what to do with me. And I don't know if I would have, if somebody tried to intervene, I don't know if I would have, you know, I don't think I would have been like, oh, yes, I see the light, you know, because that just wasn't in my personality. So I did what I do best. I got myself jobs in bars. I hung out with men that would buy me booze and whatever else I needed. And that's what I did. And I did that for, and I had a pretty good long run. You know, there's some laughs, there's some funny shit along those times, and there's a lot of tragedy and heartache, and it, you know, it's all life. And it is what it is. I certainly did not know what, I was just so removed from self, you know, just so, I guess, you know, just so numb, you know, that's the only way I know how to describe it. But I did the best I could, you know, and like I said, you couldn't tell me that I was, you know, if you said you were alcoholic, yeah, ha, 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 I worked at a bar, everybody's alcoholic, and, you know, I suffer from depression, that's what it is, you know, the alcohol helps, you know, like it wasn't, an alcoholic was the guy under the bridge in the coat with the brown paper bag. I paid my bills. At least I did for a while. By the time I was about, I had a pretty good run up until the time I was about 35. And that's when things started really, really started to spiral. And that's when I first really, I mean, I participated in criminal activity all along the way. I mean, I won't get into it, especially because this is getting taped, but and I don't know what statutes of limitations are, but there's some stuff that, you know, yeah, it, you know, did what we had to do to survive, and so anyhow, and I'll spend the rest of my life making amends for that, but, you know, I finally, the law started to catch up with me. And I had, like, when I was 16, I knocked down a cement pole, a light pole. I was at a Ford LTD. I was playing cards with these guys, and we were doing Quaaludes and drinking Canadian Club and playing poker. And I was 16, so I needed to get home. It was like 4 in the morning. Rather than call my parents, because at that point they had about given up on me, I could have just called and said I'm too messed up to come home. And finally that became normal. You know, where it was like, they were just like, just let us know that you're not coming home so we can sleep. And I knocked down a cement pole with the LTD, but I got the car home. I'm banging on the front door. My dad opens the door and he's like, who the hell hit you? Because blood's gushing out of my face. I'm like, it's not who hit me. It's what did I hit? You know, and he called the cops on me for insurance reasons. I got like a ticket for careless driving. Like, I didn't get a DW, back then I think they called them DWIs or something. That was back in the 70s. But, you know, like, and then I think I was like 25, 26. These are just some of my war stories, and then I'll stop. I was driving down Fowler Avenue at the end of a three-day run, and cop pulled me over for speeding, and I flipped my car, rolled it completely over, and I landed back where I was back up. And the cop called me, "Have you been drinking?" And I was like, "No." I remember I said, "What the hell happened?" And he's like, "You rolled your car. Have you been drinking?" And I'm like, "No, sir. I'm stressed." I said, "I've been babysitting." And that was kind of true because I was hanging out with a woman who had this, like, autistic kid that just drove me nuts and got in my way. And it was a real, you know, it was a real drag bringing him around to the bars with us, you know. Like, nah. So I told the cop I was stressed, and I'm like, "Call my dad. He'll know what to do." And the cop didn't give me, I got it, once again, careless. And I actually made money off of the insurance on the car on that one. And so the denial, like, it wasn't, but by the time I was 35, I started getting into a little bit of trouble. In a matter of a couple of weeks, I racked up a couple of felony charges. Here's one for you, burglary of a conveyance. Anybody know what that is? That's breaking into a vehicle. Yeah. Now, that's really not what happened, Your Honor. What happened, if you got the whole backstory and the whole principle of the thing, I had every right to be in that car because I was the wronged party. Okay? That was, you know. And so that's how that kind of stuff went. But I ended up in jail. I ended up in jail that night. That time I called the family. They bailed me out. A couple of weeks later, I'm back in jail. I've got cocaine, you know, felony for cocaine and DUI, and it's just a mess. And that was when I got that nudge from the judge and I got introduced to you guys. And that was back in 1997. So I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. So this is where the recovery starts. You know, I start to get a little glimmer of there might be another way. And I have, like I said, I have a lovely family, and they probably needed a rest. So I ended up in this treatment center, and I lived there from August of 97 to August of 98. I lived in that treatment center. I mean, and it was all like docs and lawyers and all these nurses, you know, all professional people. And then there was me. The last bar job I had was at Born to Ride Saloon on Nebraska, you know. And, it was like, and so I was kind of in there and I was like, "Hey, you got, you know, I Billy Badass." I hated those docs and everything. I was like, "You guys are lower than the crack addicts because, you know, they're diverting medications from sick people and stuff." I was like, "You guys are so," like, I was so angry, you know, and just hateful. But I learned a few things. I started getting some help. I learned some of the language of Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned where meetings were. But I got to tell you guys, it wasn't firing right, okay? Things just really were not firing right. Oh, my God. I used to... I had an altar that I would... One of the things they would do in treatment is they would, like, move you from room to room to see how you could deal with change and stuff. And I had this little altar because I was, like, you know, this tippy-dippy... I don't know. I was trying to find God or some kind of spiritual. I was trying to find some kind of connection. And I just had this mix-mash of Native American and Wiccan and probably a little Catholicism, all of it all rolled into one. And, you know, and I had my, and I'd burn sage and all this stuff. Oh, yeah. Did I ever tell you the sage story? Okay. Well, there were people in treatment that said the sage reminded them of marijuana. It triggered them. Stupid doctors. You know, they're just a pain, pain, pain. Uptight. So we weren't allowed to burn sage anymore. Well, I had gotten to the next level in treatment because you graduate as you go along, you know. You get a little more freedom. I love treatment. And so anyhow, I needed to burn some sage because I needed to pray because I'm moving on to this next level where I'm going into like more independent, and I'm going to go back and, you know, start working again, and, you know, waiting tables, and, you know, I'm going to have money, and, you know, so I need to pray, right? I get this sage going, I got it going really, really good. And it was going so good that it set off all the smoke alarms. And they're not smoke alarms like you have in your house. These are the smoke alarms that are connected to the fire department because it's an institutional, you know, it's an institution. So, I mean, these smoke alarms are blaring. And there was this little boy outside, one of the nurse's sons. It was on a Saturday. And the nurses had a support meeting. And this kid would run around. He was like Dennis the Menace. And I come out of the apartment and smoke's just billowing out. And this little boy looks at me. He's like, "You're gonna go to jail. You're gonna go to jail." And I grab a hold of him and I'm like, "You're a smart little boy. Make it stop. Make it stop." I figured he'd know how to trip the brake. And he's like, "You're going to jail." Oh, Lord. They didn't understand, you know, it was the principle of the thing. I needed to pray. I'm trying to find God. And they didn't buy that argument. So I graduated from treatment. I got a sponsor. They told me what I heard. This probably isn't what they told me, but this is what I heard. I heard to get a sponsor who has something you want. So I got this gal. She had a Harley. She had the boyfriend, and she hung out with the bikers that met on Monday nights. And I wanted to hang out with that crowd. So that was my sponsor. And she was great. You know, she did the best that she knew how to do. I did the best that I knew how to do. But we did not do the 12 steps as laid out in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, she probably did what she was taught, you know, and I was not in a place, I hadn't had enough, frankly. I know that now. Now, at the time, you know, I'm starting to embrace this stuff. I'm like all into it, you know. I met my Prince Charming. He had just gotten out of a 6-year stretch, and so he was all muscles and everything. And, you know, we moved in together the day I got out of treatment. And, you know, I'm going to give him the benefit of all my, because I come from a family with money, so I can tell him all about this recovery that I learned in treatment, because he didn't have those kind of opportunities. And, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, 3 months later, we're, and I'm still on probation. Made it through that. I ended up back in treatment. I don't know whatever happened to him. He did end up calling me, and that was a little bit down the road. So I'm back in treatment, second time. Got another 6 months of rehab, and I went to the Center for Women, and I lived at the expensive place because, you know, my family is like, there's not insurance for this. This was coming out of, you know, and it's like, okay, this is not going to go on forever and ever. You know, I learned a little bit along each way, but crazier than hell, just crazy. I got out again, and this time I was going to do my fourth step. So my sponsor that was with the bikers, that didn't work out for me. I needed somebody who was tough, because I'm tough. I needed somebody who's no nonsense. See, I'm calling the shots here, you know? So I found this gal, and she was kind of intimidating. She was harsh, you know, and she's going to be my sponsor. So we're on the fourth step. So I go back to the treatment center, and I said, I need to do a thorough four-step, you know, went into aftercare. And so one of the counselors there, he gave me this book from a famous treatment center up in the north that's like this thick. It's like a four-step workbook. And I mean, it was literally. So I'm dragging through that thing. Well, in the middle of it, the time came, there was no defense. You know, and I guess I wanted to use more than I wanted to stay sober. I have some suspicions on what happened to the. I just wasn't equipped that day, you know, spiritually, emotionally, whatever. It came, and I was off to the races again. And I'd had all this expensive treatment, all this knowledge. I mean, you know, at that point, I knew that I had a problem. You know, that I had learned that much. I wasn't in denial about that. But off to the races again. And that's what led me to that hotel room on May 14th. So I knew where I could go for treatment. And, you know, the Center for Women, they had a waiting list, but it didn't cost anything. So I didn't have to go to my parents to help me with the money for treatment. I, you know, had learned where the I was on a waiting list for a halfway house. And the thing was, though, at the center is they changed up the rules. You couldn't get out of pre-treatment until you gave them a clean urine. And I couldn't do it. I'd go to that pre-treatment. And, you know, so I woke up that morning on the 14th. Oh, and I'd called my dad before that, because I'm on this waiting list for the halfway house. And I did. I begged him. I was like, please, let me just come and stay with you guys. Please, please, please. You know, until a bed opens up at the halfway house, I can't stay clean where I'm at. I can't do it on my own. I just can't do it. And my dad said, Sarah, he says, we love you. He says, but you're emotionally unbalanced, and we're afraid to have you in our home. And he says, you have two things going for you. You're not dead, and you're not in jail. And he says, your mother and I will pray for you. And he hung up. And, I was pissed. I was going to get a bunch of pills and swallow it down with some booze and say, I'm calling you from my grave. I mean, I even had the line, you know? I had the line. I mean, I was like, I was going to show him. Well, I couldn't get enough money. If I got a hot $10 and went to the dope man, I couldn't get enough money for the pills and the booze. That was just too bad. I mean, I had gotten really low bottom, and I'm laughing, and it's not funny. It's sad. It really is sad. Humor is one of my defenses, though. But so anyhow, that's where it had gotten. It had gotten pretty bad. And so my family was done with me. I didn't have any friends. I was working. I was working in a restaurant, and I worked like a dog. And they knew I had a problem, but I worked so hard that, you know, I would do anything. I'd wash dishes. I'd scrub the toilets. I'd cook. Whatever you needed me to do. I think I was working more in the back of the house at that point, though, because I wasn't too clean. So I'm working, and I make a little money, and then I go and spend it, and I'm in this cycle, and I can't get out of it. And I just don't think I can hang on anymore. And I got up that morning, and even taking a bath was just too much. So I show up at the Center for Women, and this woman who was facilitating the pre-treatment group, she was talking about how it's real easy to see the consequences of our disease of alcoholism. You know, we can see the legal problems or maybe problems with the job, or maybe you start losing, you know, your possessions, your house, you know, or maybe your kids get taken away, or, you know, real easy to see that stuff, you know, because generally that's the kind of stuff that drives us in here. A lot of times are those consequences. And what she said you don't really see, or it's not as apparent, is what's going on inside. That blackness, that, you know, that spiritual hole inside. And I don't know, it just, I heard her that day, and the dam broke and the tears started, and I did what I know how to do when I'm asking for help, and that's to say, I'm going to go jump off the skyway. Because that's how I know how to ask for help, you know, at that point. And so they had, you know, because I had made that remark, they took me aside, and they, you know, and then they pointed out to me, well, obviously there's a part of you that you're not that sick and crazy. You're on a waiting list for a halfway house. You're coming here. You know, and I heard that little bit of truth, you know, and there was that bit of me, that little mustard seed of hope, you know, and this is my, I don't know, divine intervention or grace, whatever you want to call it, but why that day I didn't go, you know, somebody followed me home, we threw everything out, and that day I didn't go rooting through the garbage to get it out. you know, why that day? And that's why I'm so grateful for you guys to let me tell my story, because I got to remember that day. That day that I got some grace. You know, because I might not ever get another day like that. And from there, my recovery started. It truly started. And they wrote down on a piece of paper what I needed to do. They told me I needed to hit my knees and ask for God's help. They told me I needed to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. They told me I needed to take a bath and brush my teeth. I mean, they wrote that down on the paper too. You know, they told me I shouldn't hold any money. You know, so they were very directive with me. And then I had a friend that she saw me in the rooms and she took a little pity on me. And she said, okay, you can stay on my couch. You can stay today and we'll see how it goes. But I want to know what your hours of work are and I want to know what meeting you're going to. And I learned to be accountable and I learned how to plan 24 hours at a time. That day at a time saved my butt. Saved my butt, guys. I didn't go way out there and I just, what do I got to do today? I can do today. And I learned that early on with her. You know, she helped me with that and it clicked. The bed opened up at the halfway house, so I'm in a supportive environment. The woman that was the house manager, she taught me a lot. She said, you stay in the middle of service work. Pat Herbert, I don't know if any of you guys knew Pat. Lovely woman. She was a big brassy broad too, you know, just very, very, very English. And she was a hoot. She was a hoot. And Pat taught me a lot. And I was very privileged to be part of her death. You know, when she was dying, I was able to be there and be sober and sit in the hospice house so her daughters could go home and take care of their kids. And what a gift. What a gift that is. You know, and I learned to do that from another woman in Alcoholics Anonymous who told me when her sponsor was dying what she, you know, that she had to do, you know, she had to be helpful. And that's what, you know, that's what got her through. And I learned those things. You know, I learned them from coming here and watching what people do and then doing it myself. You know, monkey see, monkey do. That's me. You know, and also watch what people do that might get them in trouble too. You know, sometimes you can learn that way as well. But, you know, so I've had a lot of really great teachers. So I've been in that halfway house, and then my friend and I got involved in service. I had a home group. My first home group was Morning Miracles. They used to call them my grumpy old men. They met 6:30 in the morning on Nebraska, and I went to that meeting just to kind of be like, can't tell me I can't go somewhere, or dare me, because I went up, because Pat had taught me to go and thank a speaker. Speaker was talking, and he talked about traditions, and I was like, oh, I want to learn about traditions, blah, blah, blah. So I go up and shake his hand, and he, you know, and asked him where this group was, and he told me, oh, I can't go in that neighborhood. That's a bad neighborhood for me. And this other old-timer said, you can go anywhere. In Alcoholics Anonymous, you're spiritually fit. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to show them, and I'm going to be at that meeting Sunday morning. And I did, and I made it my home group, and I went every day, 7 days a week. It was all literature. So I got a really good, solid foundation and learned a lot about the traditions, and they made me their GSR, and I'd make coffee, and I'd vacuum, and all that good stuff that we tell newcomers to do. And it really was a privilege, and it helped me to be a part of. My sponsor was somebody I had met in my forays in and out. She's an interesting gal. She's very low-key, very understated. And she isn't a real directive person. Like, she's not one of those people that says, you know, it was the treatment team that was telling me, brush your teeth and pray, and do, you know, they were the ones that were. My sponsor taught me by example. And she's just a really cool lady, you know, but she's very, complete opposite, very low key, very soft spoken. But she's tougher than most people, man. She did three tours over there two in Iraq and one in Afghanistan. So she's balls to the wall, man. She's great. And she lives this life, you know. She's been sober a long time, and she models it for me. So she's shown me what service work is all about. You know, just a lot of good teachers, man. And so, you know, I'm getting therapy for some of my outside issues, you know, some of that trauma from when I was younger, and therapist is telling me, you know, you're really smart. You should go to school. You should go to school. I'm like, okay. So I'm all about following suggestions. I made a promise that I was going to follow suggestions early on. And I really did. I mean, I was like a little maybe upset, you know, rigid about it. So I go to voc rehab. I tell the lady my story. And she says, oh, honey, she says, I was 6 months sober. She says, you don't need to be going to school right now. You just need to learn how to live sober. She says, you come back here in 2 years. You're 2 years sober. Don't you know, the day that I turned 2 years sober, I went back to voc rehab and talked to them. And they did some tests. Now, in the meantime, I had a little money in the bank because guess what? I'm 2 years sober and I'm not spending it all on, you know, I'm living normally. I'm in my amends. I got my credit built back up. I made my financial amends. I'm paying people back. You know, I worked the steps in the big book. My step four, which I kind of alluded to before, I learned when I did that with Lori. What I learned is I'm not a victim. That those horrible things that happened, that's in the past. I'm the one who's bringing them in today. Those people are dead, gone, whatever, you know? But I'm the one who's having the relationship with them today, you know? And that empowered me, you know? Because I'm like, damn straight, right now, where are my feet? I'm okay. It doesn't mean that I'm in denial or I'm, you know, because there's things that I grieve and I'm sad and I, you know, and I think it's appropriate. You know, I can have honest emotions today about, you know, what happened. But so anyhow, the steps today when I'm working with women, I ask them, I'm like, when they're, you know, whatever the situation is, I'm like, okay, what steps would you apply to that situation? How can you use the steps? How can you apply these principles to help you cope with this problem? Because that's where it is, you know? It's a design for living, and it's a way of maybe looking at whatever the situation is from a different angle or a different perspective. And for this alcoholic, it's been a lifesaver. And it's also made me a lot easier to live around and be around and, you know, have in your life because, you know, I've learned to pause. When agitated, we pause, you know, think about what would the next right action be. And if I don't know, I can ask somebody. I got all of you guys and your great wisdom, you know. One of you guys has been through it, been there, done that. I've heard my story at this podium hundreds of times since I've been here. One of the things I heard when I first came in, they said, if you wrote down what you thought your life was going to be like in 10 years, you'd be blown away if you stay sober and you look back in 10 years. And that's been my experience. They did not lie to me. So 2 years, I go to voc rehab, got a little money, found out I am smart. You know, I dropped out of high school when I was 15. I got a GED, and now I'm getting ready to go to community college. It's 2004, and off I go, class at a time, a day at a time, a semester at a time, you know, how do you eat that elephant? A bite at a time. And, you know, I grew into my academic life just like I'm growing, like I am still continuing to grow in my recovery and my spirituality and my life today. I think Alcoholics Anonymous, being sober, has given me the opportunity to become the woman I would have been had I not, you know, put those substances into my body at such a young age as a coping mechanism, you know. And not everybody gets a do-over. I got a do-over, you know. So did well in school. I had my first graduation with my AA degree in 2007. I waited tables while I was going to school. You know, learned, got Pell Grants, so I pretty much broke even. Went to USF. USF, oh my gosh, what a beautiful campus. I'd be walking around the campus and the Bougainvillea and stuff, and I'm like, I can't believe I'm here, you know? I mean, it was just surreal, you know, from working at the biker bars, or what were some of the bars that I worked at? Oh my God, I've worked in some doozies. The Hitch and Post Lounge, I met my love at the Saddle Up Saloon down in Davie, Florida. I drank in all the nice places, you know? And I worked in those places, you know, and I mean, oh my Lord, yeah. So anyhow, I did really well at USF, and an opportunity came my way. And here's one thing that I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that has been invaluable and is invaluable for me today, and I have to remember this, so I say it out loud a lot, is I'm responsible to suit up and show up. I'm not responsible for the outcomes. If I can honestly say, you know what, I came, I did my best, then you know what, that's good, especially for a drunk like me, you know? And what's been amazing is the outcomes overall have been pretty darn good. I ended up getting tried out for this competitive grant. It was research experience for undergraduates, and that's when I first started coming to the 164 group. And I don't know if you remember me crying out in the parking lot and stuff. It's like, God, it was very hard. It was a summer grant. They paid a stipend and you got credits, but it introduced me to research, and I got a job on campus, so I didn't have to wait tables. And then that job on campus led to a graduate assistantship, so I went to grad school. Can you imagine? I graduated in 2011, and it's all of this, the only thing I did right is I suit up and show up. It's Alcoholics Anonymous. This is what I learned in here, you know. I learned from you guys. It's what I learned in here. And, you know, do the best I can, and I don't drink no matter what. I can remember being in that halfway house, and it just was like, it was like a light bulb going off over my head. And I was like, if I don't pick up that drink, I got a chance. I take that drink, all bets are off. I might come back. It's like playing Russian roulette. For a drunk like me, it's like playing Russian roulette. And I don't know when my time, that bullet might go off one time. And I'm not willing to gamble that today. I'm not willing to gamble it. It's not worth it. I don't want to be that person that breaks my mother's heart. I can remember, you know, I told you about that phone call with my daddy, and he said, you know, your mother and I will pray for you. I was sober for a short time. And I remember calling my mom, and I could hear something different in her voice. And you know what it was? It was hope. She wasn't walking on eggshells around me. There was a little bit of hope in her voice. I don't want to break my mama's heart. You know? I don't want to be that girl that does that. I'm running out of time. If you're an alcoholic, this is the place to be. These principles, find God of your understanding that can grow, it can change. That's been my experience. Anyhow, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. It really is. It's been a great ride, and I look forward to more adventures with you guys in the next several years, and we'll just have a great old time, won't we? So anyhow, thanks.
Thank you.
Such a goofball.
You're an awesome goofball.